From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. Happy Friday, everybody. I'm John Raby, sitting in for John Horn. Today, how do you get more women of color into symphony orchestras? The Colburn School in L.A. has a plan. Then we'll listen back to my conversation with sci-fi writer Harlan Ellison. When he died last week, so did a uniquely cranky voice who once wrote In Storefront Windows.
To prove to people that writing is a job of work, that it is not done by some sort of black-cloaked sorcerer on a glass mountaintop, that it's like tilling a field or repairing a toilet. It's a job of work.
And the 1968 Beatles film Yellow Submarine returns to theaters. All that coming up on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Raby, in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The classical music world has a diversity problem. People of color make up less than 15% of all orchestra musicians. Women of color, even less. But as KPCC arts education reporter Carla Javier tells us, a group of young female musicians at the Colburn School in downtown L.A. is trying to change the system.
Jasmine Morales grew up in two different musical worlds. She's a classically trained violinist who participated in youth orchestra. She also played mariachi and Mexican folk music.
I eventually became the concertmaster of the regional youth orchestra where I lived, but I was always lacking the sense of empowerment and community that I felt when I would make music with my mariachi peers.
A decade later, she thinks young women of color face similar challenges.
So it's kind of jarring to go into a concert hall where you're watching the musicians that you respect most in the world and not one of them looks like you. It makes it feel as if that's not really a space you can enter.
A spokeswoman says there are 13 women of color in the LA Phil out of about 100 musicians, but she declined to provide a more specific demographic breakdown. Even in big orchestras with big budgets around the country, a 2016 League of American Orchestra study says less than 3% of orchestra musicians are Black or Latino. And the study didn't even look at how many or how few of those were women. It's one of the biggest challenges facing classical music today. League of American Orchestra's president and CEO Jesse Rosen says the future of orchestras
really depends upon continual refreshing and reinventing in our context. The context of America today is that of a country that is becoming increasingly diverse.
Which brings us back to L.A. and Jasmine Morales, who is now the coordinator of community engagement and career development at Colburn. She thought of her challenges as a woman of color in classical music, and
when I sort of came full circle into a career in arts management and back in the classical world, that I wanted to work to change that for other young women of color in classical music.
So she created a fellowship for those young women of color. In music, if you're supposed to play or sing something loudly, you write a little F. It means forte, the word for strong. But if you want musicians to kick it up a notch and play really loud and be really strong, you write two Fs, fortissimo. Morales wants her first class of fellows to be really strong. That's why she calls them the Fortissima Fellows. You're listening to them right now. They're already pretty loud. The six young musicians go to different high schools, they're different ages, they play different instruments and identify differently racially and religiously. Yet they all say they were immediately friends from their very first meeting last October. Fellow Jacqueline Rodriguez, who plays the cello, has a guess as to why.
Sometimes you don't meet musicians, especially musicians of color. So, like, knowing that we have those similarities, I think that's exactly what made us, like, have a really strong bond.
And they all know what it's like to enter a world with its own very specific rules. So they're paired with mentors, take private music lessons, and together they've attended workshops in mindfulness, confidence, even etiquette. Morales says she designed those around what she wishes she knew when she was their age.
That one time that I showed up to this dinner and felt humiliated when I used the wrong fork, or, you know, when I broke down before a performance and froze on stage because I couldn't control how I was talking to myself in my brain.
And outside the program, they have an active group chat and go to each other's performances and recitals. Stefania Hartoyo, a viola player from San Gabriel, says having this group of young women to lean on means a lot to her.
I'm really insecure, but when I'm in this group, it's like I can just be myself, and these people are just like family and friends.
They say when they're together, they're inseparable, which I kind of get, because when I'm not pointing my microphone at them, they're holding each other's hands and hugging. And every time one of them says something they agree with...
Is there a lot of snapping in this group?
Yeah.
They're in high school, so they have some time to really think about the future. but like violinist Kara Innes from Carson, nearly all of them say that eventually they want to bring music to people like them.
Teach other girls of color, teach other girls who feel insecure in the big orchestra setting. Use all of what we've learned, like spread it around so that way people like us won't feel the way we do now.
Or snaps. Meanwhile, their mentor, Jasmine Morales, is holding back tears.
It's been the most rewarding experience of my life to be able to meet you all. None of us knew what was going to happen when we decided to embark on this adventure together, but I think it's been an amazing couple of months, and I think we have even more to look forward to.
For The Frame, I'm Carla Javier.
On a related note, NPR is reporting that Boston Symphony Orchestra principal flutist Elizabeth Rowe has filed a lawsuit against the orchestra, claiming she is making substantially less each year than her closest peer, who's a man. Rowe's suit was filed in the Massachusetts Superior Court as a new statewide equal pay law went into effect. She's asking for more than $200,000 in unpaid wages from the orchestra. She says that she is currently the top-paid female principal player in the BSO, while the orchestra's principal oboist, John Ferrillo, is the symphony's top-paid male. According to the orchestra's tax records, in 2016, Ferrillo was paid $286,000, which is the largest salary paid to any Boston Symphony principal musician. Rowe says Ferrillo's role in the orchestra is the most comparable to her own, and yet she is paid approximately 75% of what he's getting. And we close out the first part of our show with this.
We can't have madmen out there shooting rockets all over the place. And by the way, Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. Little Rocket Man.
During their summit last month in Singapore, President Trump reportedly asked Kim Jong-un if he'd ever heard Elton John's Rocket Man. The North Korea leader had not. So, on Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's current trip to North Korea, he's bringing a gift from Trump, an Elton John CD that includes Rocket Man. I guess Kim is not into the vinyl renaissance. Anyway, we wondered what Elton song Kim would suggest to Trump. So tweet your recommendations to us at The Frame. Coming up, we listen back to my 2013 interview with sci-fi author Harlan Ellison in his home, which he called the Lost Aztec Temple of Mars. He died last week at 84.
KPCC supporters include Center Theater Group presenting The Humans, Stephen Karam's 2016 Tony Award winner for Best Play. Charles McNulty of the Los Angeles Times said, "The Humans has come to L.A. at full strength. If there's a better ensemble working in America right now than the extraordinary cast of The Humans at the Amundsen Theater, I'm unaware of its existence. The Humans, featuring the original Broadway company, only at the Amundsen, now through July 29th. More information at AmundsenTheater.org.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Raby. Science fiction writer Harlan Ellison died last week at 84. He wrote some 1,800 novels, stories, articles, and screenplays in 7 decades as a writer, including one of the most famous Star Trek episodes, The City on the Edge of Forever. It's fair to say that Ellison was a justifiably famous writer and a certifiably infamous personality. He was abrasive and litigious and was probably lucky he wasn't working in the Me Too era. In our interview, he was compelling and charming, but when he phoned to complain about it after, not so much. It was almost exactly 5 years ago that I interviewed him at his house in Sherman Oaks, which he called the Lost Aztec Temple of Mars. It was soon after a publisher reprinted some of Ellison's earliest work.
And one of the books she did was a book that I had been, well, frankly, ashamed of and kept under wraps for at least 40 years. I did it in a time of destitution and needing money. And they are stories from my days when I ran with a kid gang in New York, in Brooklyn, purposely to get background to write my first novel, Web of the City, and a subsequent biography about my time with the gang and time I spent in jail. And I ran with them for 6 weeks, got in, and I became their war master and was in rumbles and with zip guns and chains and knives. And I did my first novel, Web of the City, about that. and I did many stories that were set in that milieu. The stories were, to my eye then, very crude.
What do you have to have in a juvenile delinquent novel? What are the hallmarks of it? The three or four things that have to be in there?
Sex and violence, pre-Hunter Thompson, new wave journalism writing. It's tough. It's very tough, gritty stuff.
Can I just run a few facts by you here? These are stuff I got off the internet, and so I thought you could say yes or no, or tell me two or three words about
it. From that imbecile Wikipedia.
Right. No, of course not. I never use that. You once wrote a story in front of a storefront window in New York City. What was the point of this?
To prove to people that writing is a job of work, that it is not done by some sort of black-cloaked sorcerer on a glass mountaintop, that it's like tilling a field or repairing a toilet. It's a job of work. But everybody thinks they can do three things with great alacrity and enthusiasm and skill and uniqueness. They all think they can write. They all think they can have sex. And they all think they can drive a car. These are three skills which take enormous coordination and sense of spatial relationships and practice. This is to prove to people who are wannabes and have this love-hate relationship with writing. They want to be writers, but they're too lazy to do the actual work. The internet has spawned a generation of illiterates who have no understanding of the proprietary right of the creator. And they think anything that they find on the internet, they can have. The internet is not writing. That's sort of idle farting. Blogs are, my cat took a crap on the piano today. That's not writing. That's not Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. It's not Colette. It's not Dumas. Writing is a specific craft, and it takes what Balzac called clean hands and composure.
We're fact-checking with Harlan Ellison. Among your odd jobs, hired gun for a wealthy neurotic?
Yep. A nut job took a liking to me when I was in high school, and he packed me with a Walther PBK and sent me out on what I thought were stupid jobs, and I thought it was a gag until somebody took a shot at me.
You love Judge Judy.
I used to.
What happened?
Well, two things happened. Judy reached menopause, and it didn't sit well with her, and she's a cranky old lady. The other thing is I grew old, and I grew restless with the human race. I grew impatient with a species that can send someone to the moon, that can paint the Sistine Chapel ceiling, that can write Moby Dick, and also has to worry about whether the tailor shrunk their coat or their stupid pit bull bit somebody else's Yorkie. And so I can't watch Judge Judy anymore. That was one of my guilty pleasures. Now it's something stupid like Pawn Stars.
I love Pawn Stars. That's great.
I love Pawn Stars. Talk about dyslexic families. Jesus. I mean, why haven't they savaged each other into oblivion by now? I don't know.
Enough fact-checking. I've been reading a particular genre for years. I have only just read in preparation for this interview, and I've read thousands of stories, and I somehow missed I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, which you wrote in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
An incredibly bleak story about the computer that man built to wage its final war,
yeah,
which saves four or five people from death and keeps them underground and tortures them
forever. Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever read anything that bleak.
It's one of my many stories that is an atheist tract. And what it basically says is machines are only as good as we are. I postulated a future society which was at odds with itself, divided into three major parts, which were the Mideast, the Far East, and the rest of the world. And each of them had a supercomputer. And at some point, the supercomputers gained sentience and all linked up. And they programmed the war so that the human race would lose. And Am, this omnipotent god, basically human and basically evil, because it has no purpose. It's been built, but it's got nowhere to go. Brought down five human beings to torture them endlessly to show them what they had created and what was left for them. And we later did it as a PC game. It's called I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, and you cannot win it. There's no way you can get out of that game winning. The only thing you can do is play it nobly. I did it as an exercise in saying to the human race, look how good you can be and look how stupid you are. That's my job, to antagonize the complacent. It's my job on this planet to annoy people. I'm not here to tell you how wonderfully you're doing. All you have to do is look out around you at the good things you've done, and you'll know how good. When you do bad, here am I, smart-ass Ellison, to tell you what you've done bad.
I'm John Raby, and today for John Horn, and what we're listening to is a conversation I recorded with the late science fiction writer Harlan Ellison in his home back in 2013.
we're sitting in your living room in your house, the Lost Aztec Temple of Mars, looking at a case of miniature historical soldiers.
Historical miniatures, what used to be called toy soldiers from all periods, from Quetzalcoatl to World War II. This house, I'm on 200 acres of watershed land, which will never be built on, and I've added to this house, we now have something like 210,000 square feet in this house. Secret rooms, underground passages, tower, a three-story tower, the front wall, which is the last Lost Aztec Temple of Mars. We got gargoyles on the outside of the house. The Hollywood tour bus used to come by the house. They didn't know who lived here, but they say, we don't know who lives here, but isn't this a really weird-looking house, you know?
How many books do you have? Do you have any idea?
Yes, I have a very good idea how many books I have. I have 750,000 books in the house. I haven't taken you around the house. You've only been sitting here in the living room. But in this room, for instance, the walls are covered with originals by Picasso, Dario Campanile, James Gurney, who did Dinotopia, Leo and Diane Dillon, who did the covers for all my books. And most of the art here are pieces of artwork from my stories.
All salon style, by the way, filling the walls.
Yeah. Here begins the books. This is the paperbacks from, I think, in this room, there's only about maybe 5,000 or 6,000 paperbacks in this room, which run from A to B. This is my beautiful wife, Susan.
Hi, Susan.
How high is the heat today?
Oh, miserable.
Miserable. Very good, dear. This is our kitchen. This is the Art Deco dining pavilion that I built. It was a blank wall with a window in it, and right out there on the slope is where the sniper lay waiting to take a shot at me. These are all Wedgwood mugs, and I like keeping them on display, but then that made for very difficult cabinet space, so I designed cabinets. I design cabinets that open out like this.
The mug cabinet is actually a door of a cabinet.
Yeah, and it's a door within a door. And that's the way the house is. Nothing is what it seems to be. Everything is hidden behind something else. For the radio audience, you don't know this, but John is kind of a homunculus. He's gigantic. He's very, very big. How tall are you, John?
In real life, I'm 6'5".
6'5". Well, I'm 5'5". So I have to look up at you, but all the doors in the house are built for people 5'5", which means poor John, as he's taking you through the tour, is bending over double. And then coming in this direction, we have...
Stop at the script here.
On the wall framed here is the script of The Simpsons I did.
Just this year.
Just this year, where I played Harlan Ellison. Milhouse turns, says something to the comic book guy, and the comic book guy says, why don't you ask Harlan Ellison? He turns around, and there I am, and I give him...
like an Annie Hall.
Yeah. And
well, you don't know a thing about my work.
Exactly. Marshall McLuhan. This is the bedroom.
More books in here, hey.
Oh, more books everywhere, and underneath there are still more books.
The bed is on a platform. This is beautiful.
Now, the reason the bed is on the platform is because the window is very high up, and when you're in the bed, you can look out across 40 miles to the San Bernardino Mountains. This is the famous artist Charles Bragg. This is Frank Miller original.
We toured Cheech Marin's house with all his beautiful Latino art, and there's something about living with art like this.
Oh, yeah. It enhances your everyday. Every day I get up and I look at this black and white, for instance, of Don Quixote. The kid who did that was an amateur. I bought that at an amateur art exhibition. He died shortly thereafter. One of the last things he said was, it's a great honor to have my art hanging next to a Charles Bragg in Harlan Ellison's bedroom.
And I like it's in the bedroom, too. You see this stuff. You see it every single day.
Every day I look at it, and every day I'm surrounded by the best of my times. Life is a load of memories.
That was writer Harlan Ellison from July of 2013 speaking with me at his Sherman Oaks home for my show Off Ramp. Ellison died last week at the age of 84. Coming up on the frame, bringing back the Beatles' Yellow Submarine. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Raby. 50 years ago, the Beatles' animated film Yellow Submarine brought the Fab Four's psychedelic music together with revolutionary animation techniques. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and Eleanor Rigby achieved new resonance through stunning visuals, and new songs like Hey Bulldog were introduced with the release of the film. Now a new digital restoration brings the vibrancy of the original film back to the big screen. Paul Rutan Jr. oversaw the painstaking restoration process, which took 4 years to complete. He spoke with the Frame's John Horn about how he used various prints and the tattered remains of the original 1968 negative to restore the film. The first step was getting his hands on all the originals from Apple Corps, the company the band created in 1968.
Fortunately, Apple had all the materials I could possibly get, so they sent me a ton of film. Cans and cans and cans and cans. A lot of it was marked no good, and it was good. A lot of it was from a poor digital, but wasn't poor then, but a poor digital restoration they did in 2008 or 2009. 1998, I'm sorry. And I had to weed that out because it was unusable. So basically, I went through every foot of film that they sent me to see what I could use, what I couldn't use, and how to come together with the correct version.
You have done restoration work on some other Beatles films, including Hard Day's Night and Help. Is there a different challenge when you're dealing with animation as opposed to live action?
In this case, there was, because it was, for me, it was really important to retain the nuances of the original artwork. When you're shooting something live action, it's pretty easy for me to be able to reproduce and restore what the show is supposed to look like and perhaps make it look better and remove the scratches and the dirt. But in this particular case, there were brush strokes. There were little cell differences from the animation that I wanted to retain. It gives it its feel, and it's also indicative of the era that it was made.
I want to play a section from the film. It's a John Lennon song that I think we all know. It's a great song, and it's also a really distinct animation style. I don't even know how I would begin to describe what the animation for this sequence looks like.
It's my absolute favorite animated sequence in the film because there's references to John's history about dancing. And even though the Beatles weren't involved with this film, this whole sequence, it's not just about Lucy on the horse. It's about dancing, and you've got all different types of dancing in it. You've got Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and then you've got swing dancing. Then you have jazz dancing, and it's all a montage, dissolved sequences of dancing. Whoever, you know, whichever animator did that or decided to do that. For me, I'm a championship ballroom dancer, so I saw that. I was doing that when I worked on the film, and I didn't remember it because I wasn't ballroom dancing in 1968, and I looked at that, and I said, wow.
Did you get up and start dancing around in your restoration lab?
Probably. I just thought it was a fantastic piece.
The thing that's really remarkable about this film is that it is an amalgam of so many different styles. How they actually pulled it all together is a miracle in and of itself, but that each sequence can be radically different from the next, and you're trying to come up with, I guess you're trying to figure out what the intention of every artist was, even though there are so many different artists and styles. You're like mind reading from the past.
Well, being a mind reader, it seemed to me that they did a lot of research because there's a lot of similarities in the individual Beatles characters, like Paul, like George, with the cars. Who knew? And with Ringo, that he went through depression sometimes, and they did their homework, and then they put it all together. So it's basically a little bit of a capsule about really who these people were, even though they were cartoon characters.
I want to play another sequence from the film. It's, I would say, one of the saddest songs the Beatles ever wrote. It's Eleanor Rigby. Look at all the lovely people. I find this song really sad, but I have to say the animation isn't. There's almost a joy to it. There's a sequence involving soccer players. There's a real fun in some of the animation in this sequence, and it's a totally different style than Lucy in the Sky.
Well, what's interesting about that sequence is that all the people were real. And this is what Bob Balzer talked to me about. He actually told me who the people were. They were either involved in the production. There were storekeepers from Liverpool that were in that. It's a remarkable sequence in that way, you know. And yeah, it's a sad song, but again, the joy is in that it's about life.
Yeah.
You know, it's really about life.
So who is Bob Balzer and what was his relationship to the overall look and design of the film?
He was one of the head animators. And fortunately, he's since passed on, but he was living at the time and volunteered to come and work with me on doing the film.
How did you get into this line of work? What's your background?
I actually started working for my father. Nepotism is rampant or was in our business in 1974. And that was pretty much before any kind of restoration was going on. And what we did was we converted a theatrical version like CinemaScope, Technicolor 3-strip, all different kinds of obsolete formats so that it could play on television. And we did it in 35mm and 16mm. He lost his businesses in the advent of videotape transfer, which is what they did and what they do now. And then all of a sudden, the whole thing opened up with restoration, and I seemed to be at the door.
Paul Rattan, thanks for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And that's our show for this week. I'm John Raby. John Horn's back Monday. Stay cool this weekend.